Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nicholas Investment Insights. While Australia's relative success in containing the virus means the economy is reopening quicker than in many other countries, the after effects may linger for years, especially once you factor in continued national border controls and halted major economy drivers like immigration, tourism and international students. Not surprisingly, Australian house prices fell the most in 16 months in June and face significant downside risk as mortgage holidays and government wage subsidies expire in the coming months. Can Scott Morrison deliver on his promise of higher house prices under a coalition government, or will the epidemic steer the national one-way road to riches into a cul-de-sac? Here to ask the question, will the coronavirus kill Australian property? I have sitting across from me at a Chairman Dan mandated distance, Nicholas Wells, Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Jim.
We also have on line one our Chief Economist, Leith Van Onselen. Hello, Leith.
G'day, Jim.
And on line two, we have our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello to you, David.
G'day, Tim.
Lovely. Great to have you both on the show. And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and to click the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch. And follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat box below at nucleuswealth.com/webinar. So let's jump into it. So the agenda for today, we're going to start by looking at the virus as a unique challenge to the Australian growth model. We'll then be rolling into mass immigration and international students, the foreign buyer's role in property, looking at the rental crash, looking then from there at the 1.3 million loss-making landlords, policy exhaustion and options, and then finishing up as we do, looking at this from an investment sense with implications on how we run money here at Nucleus Wealth. So with no further ado, I'll hand over to David to get us started. The virus is a unique challenge to Australian growth, Dave.
That's right, Tim. So just to kick us off, this is a kind of a top-down view on how the virus may impact the key Australian growth drivers in particular. You know, those external facing drivers that are all being made more problematic, as you say, as national borders close and people movement restrictions are in place for a long time. So as we probably all know, you know, immigration's played a very large role in driving Australian GDP for the last, 15 years or so, but in particular, since the mining bust of 2011. When you run through the list of sectors that directly benefit from high population growth, which is, you know, hugely driven by immigration, education, tourism, construction, banking, retail property, and professionals, a huge slab of the services economy that Australia adores so much, we're talking, you know, upwards of 40% of employment. So it's an enormous part of the Australian growth story for the last decade, and it is fundamentally challenged by the virus. Sticking with the top down for a moment, we've got a chart in here which basically compares Australian GDP versus GDP per capita, and you can see that since the GFC, but in particular 2011, again with the mining bust, GDP has hugely outperformed GDP per capita, and that is the symptom of this mass immigration model where you're constantly bringing in people to juice your output, but by doing so, of course, you're diminishing everybody's slice in that output. And the key macroeconomic variable that's come out of that is that it's been very deflationary for wages and various other prices, which has driven the cash rate, monetary policy, to zero now. That in turn has also lifted many of these service sector sectors that have driven Australian growth for the last decade. And so you've had this sort of twin tailwind that comes from immigration doing these things to the economy. But it does as well as sort of hiding the downsides of of falling per capita GDP, it has more obvious downsides that are, you know, very unique to Australia as a developed market. And that is basically because of all these other service sector sectors doing well. excuse me, it has tended to keep currency high. And even though I've said that it is deflationary and has dropped the cash rate, it's actually at the same time held the cash rate higher than other jurisdictions. And that's resulted in what was, you know, more chronically high currency than our external sectors could cope with, other than mining. And so ex-mining tradables have continued to be hollowed out in Australia. We've had a few little manufacturing bounces, but the trend remains down for, you know, its proportion of GDP. And we stand alone almost, you know, with maybe Liechtenstein or similar kind of financialized economies with a, you know, a manufacturing output of GDP at around between 5% and 6% now, which is, you know, half other supposedly hollowed out economies like the UK and considerably smaller even than you know, what's transpired in the US. But the key point is that that hollowing out has continued to happen even post the mining bust.
It's basically a classic case of Dutch disease, you'd say.
Well, it's double Dutch disease, in fact, because you're getting a currency priced off certain bulk commodities, plus this service sector inflation that immigration drives.
Yeah, and sorry, let me put that in context for the listeners. Is Dutch disease is like is basically where your commodity sector is so big that it basically subsumes all these other sectors in your economy, and then so you basically you end up with your whole economy based around just producing these commodities, say iron ore and gas, and that pushes the Australian dollar up so high that none of the manufacturing sectors can survive. And so that, as we saw, all the car manufacturers all shut down, whatever that was, 10, 15 years ago. And so sort of, as David said, hollows out your economy. So you're left with this economy that when the commodities finally pull back, the economy is actually the resulting economy has actually got nothing left to support it, because it's already got rid of all the industries that could have actually taken place.
So other than debt, basically, with your external sector retrenching, you're left with either private or public debt to drive growth. excuse me, and of course we've got the highest, or second highest, I think it's household debt to GDP in the world, and we do still have quite low public debt, but we also have a culture of keeping it that way. So that's not necessarily a growth advantage. So the conclusion to take out of this first slide basically is that, you know, without immigration, we face a long and very difficult and very deflationary bust, basically, as we have to rebuild tradable sectors to grow. And that includes, you know, chronically higher unemployment than we're used to. So that's your basic top-down view as we push in, you know, towards, immigration in more detail and the role it plays in property. So I'll just pass over to Leith, who's going to give us a detailed take on where immigration stands today.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Look, as we all know, Australia's immigration intake's been absolutely massive over the past 15 years. We've averaged about 220,000 net overseas migration over the period, and it's actually increased more in the past. It's been a lot higher in the past decade than it was over the first 5 years of the 15-year period. And because of COVID-19, because Australia's borders are effectively sealed shut, net overseas migration is estimated by the Morrison government to collapse over this year and also next year by around 85%. And there there aren't a whole lot of forecasts out there other than that, except one from Paul Risby, who's a former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Home Affairs. And he tips that the stock of temporary migrants alone in Australia, which has been one of the key drivers of net overseas migration, is going to fall by 600,000 alone in 2020. So to put that into context, we had nearly 2.5 million temporary migrants in Australia as at the end of 2019, and that figure's supposed to fall by about 600,000 this year. And according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics data, around three quarters of migrants coming to New South Wales and Victoria, and around two thirds coming to Sydney and Melbourne. So Sydney and Melbourne in particular, as we know, are the key bubble epicentres in the Australian housing market. They're expected to bear the brunt of the falling in international students and temporary migration and net overseas migration. And so obviously with far fewer people coming into Australia, much lower population growth than expected, that will strip a lot of demand out of the market. And as we know, markets are set by supply and demand. So if you obviously strip out a whole bunch of demand, it's going to, other things equal, tank prices and also rents. We'll get onto the rents issue shortly and some of these other things, but we're already seeing it in the market with both rents and prices now falling. And there's every likelihood, even, notwithstanding all the other headwinds we're facing, that just those factors alone will take a lot of steam out of the market and weigh down on prices. And we're seeing that with just about every property lobby group and universities and all these areas of the economy that Dave mentioned earlier, basically screaming out to quickly reflate immigration as quickly as possible post COVID-19. We've already seen the universities lobbying to try and bring in international students under the so-called safe corridors or strict quarantine, which doesn't really exist. So there is pressure on governments to try and increase it back to what it was. However, we believe it's going to be very difficult to reboot immigration, even after the next, following 18 months, owing to Australia having structurally high unemployment and obviously, low wage growth, which is going to remove an incentive to come here if it's very hard to get a job.
It's probably not well known that those market forces are actually quite a large part of the driver of immigration. It's not all just about the government issuing a certain number of visas. There is a demand element to it as well, which is what you're referencing there.
And particularly when, looking at people coming from a country where they probably have some sort of support network in terms of relatives and others to help them if they did lose a job, and saying if you're going to uproot yourself and bring yourself to a country, a long way away, and with the potential, and if that country's got underemployment of 20%, and who knows what the real unemployment rate is, but it's probably north of 12% at least. It's obviously a lot more difficult to do that than what it was during the financial crisis, where Australia was put out to be a sort of a bit of a safe haven in terms of losing your finance jobs or losing your jobs in London or New York. There's still a the Australian economy is going quite well at the time, and the mining boom sort of from China pushing things along was quite good at drawing in immigrants looking for jobs.
Yes, absolutely. And so we're looking at obviously structurally higher unemployment and all the political resistance that comes around that. It's going to be very hard to ramp up immigration when you have so many Australians unemployed and also struggling to earn a crust. At the same time, we've witnessed in Melbourne massive quarantine failures.
I'll just add to that, Leith, just on the political resistance. We've already seen the Labor opposition turn tail on temporary visas. Work visas, and so there is real political pressure already to prevent any quick snapback.
Mm. Absolutely.
On these just putting these numbers in context as well. So for anyone sort of who's listening in and not seeing the graph, so we've got at least got this graph up showing temporary visas sort of rising from about 1.6 million in 2011 up to 2.4 million in 2019, then dropping back to 1.8. So how much of that is going to be, or if any of that is tourism? So I guess what I'm thinking is a tourist from the US, for example, doesn't need a temporary visa, but a tourist from, say, China probably does, I think. Is that right?
Well, very little of it, because these temporary visas on issue tend to be longer-term temporary visas. So this doesn't count your 2 week holiday maker that comes to Australia or someone who comes here on a very short term basis. And the growth in these temporary visas has actually been predominantly from international students. And there have been some other areas too, like increasing bridging visas and the like, but it's mostly international students that have driven this increase.
Yeah.
So
this would actually understate the fall potentially if it doesn't include the vast bulk of tourism.
No, not well. Actually, I'm not quite sure of that because in a given year, more Australians actually travel overseas on holidays than overseas people come here. Yeah. So,
on the inflow side, I guess.
Definitely on the inflow side, but also obviously Australians wouldn't be travelling abroad. So, you can pretty much discount that. But but certainly most of this fall is going to be in the international student space. And the only data I've seen on this being reported is that as of May, there was already 20% less international students in Australia than there was at the end of last year. So we had about 960,000 enrolled as of the end of 2019. And that was already down by 20%. And obviously we're going to have no inflows this year.
That's right.
So of that 20% total international student numbers were down, Chinese student numbers were down by over a third. And obviously the Chinese students tend to be higher income and also tend to be more active in the property market. So, you can understand why the property industry is basically panicking. And we're seeing we'll get on to this shortly, but just as a bit of a primer, we're seeing this with a massive increase in vacancy rates in the CBDs, particularly where international students congregate most. It's certainly going to have a massive impact on the rental marketing particularly, but also property values and investors, which we'll get to shortly. And also, as we've seen, Melbourne's had epic quarantine failures, which has actually spurred on the transmission of COVID-19, and New Zealand's experienced similar. So any attempt to try and ramp up the intake with this, you know, quarantine approach is fraught with danger. And it's going to be, you know, quite easy to resist.
Well, I'm going to push back on that one for a minute. I'd be interested to take the devil's advocate view on these. Is that if we're saying at a certain stage, people will just go, this is the world we live in now. Coronavirus is out. You need to limit your exposure to it. But in the end, it's in so many countries and so many areas, it's effectively unstoppable. Is whether, you know, it turns into a mitigation strategy rather than trying to stop it. Under that scenario, what are the tools? You know, let's say you're an advisor to Mr. Morrison, who says, Leith, I need you to jam as many migrants down into Australia as we possibly can. What's our strategy for bringing them in?
Well, just think though. I mean, even if that's true and they try and quarantine them, we're looking at many hundreds of thousands of international students that come in every year. It's just the logistical, the logistical needs of trying to house hundreds of thousands is difficult. It's also incredibly expensive, and who pays?
Yeah.
If it's the students in the universities who have to pay, well, obviously that's going to add to either the course fees. Or it's going to smash profit margins. And we also mustn't forget that some of Australia's biggest source countries for international students are actually heavily affected by the virus. So China's okay. China's our biggest, but our second biggest is India. Yeah. And then Nepal, and we've obviously got Brazil and places like this. The virus is running rampant.
Now, Leith, I know I was trying to give you a political position, but you've avoided my question there.
I'll take it on.
Take that
for
one.
You.
Yeah, I guess maybe can I give one extra part to that, David?
Sure.
To say, let's give it 6 months, and there's a mixture of, you know, maybe there's some vaccines that are being tested, or the cures have got to the stage where, hospitals aren't being overrun. Things are sort of bubbling away in the background, but it's still out there everywhere, but it's not the front of everyone's mind. It's about saying, yeah, okay, it's something we just need to manage in the background.
Well, I mean, I'd just point to Victoria today. You know, I mean, we may not have quite made that psychological leap yet, but I mean, Australia has kind of prided itself on next to eliminating the virus.
Yeah.
The political reaction to a new outbreak in Victoria has been very intense. The federal government's trying to water it down a bit, but the South Australian government immediately shut the border. New South Wales is charging anyone who comes across the border illegally $10,000 on the spot. I'm living in an area that's got roadblocks. You know, I mean, that world that you describe where coronavirus is simply part of life and we manage it, you know, manage the risk of it on a day-to-day basis, it is a long way from becoming a reality here. Mm. It might be more the case in places where it's clearly, you know, skipped any hope, like the US, for instance. But, you know, we're pretty paranoid about this virus, and there seems to be an acceptance still at the moment that political success relies on virus success, that is, keeping it out. So I think we're a long way from any sort of comfort zone with it.
Mm. Well, I mean, all you have to do is look at the interstate travel blockades that have gone up. I mean,
yeah,
you
know, but
if Victorians have got a very low infection rate, can't even travel to interstate, I mean, it's going to be pretty hard to try and ramp up international rivals, especially when Australians aren't even allowed to travel overseas.
Sure, but in perspective, if Victoria was a state in the US, we'd be doing a fantastic job still. We'd be like one of the, you know. What's Victoria doing right? So how did they get to this stage?
Yeah,
let's say
we can't even travel.
Sure, but let's say the US gets to the stage where the US gets to the stage where they're like, okay, we're past this, we're just going to live with this now, guys. And the UK is in the same position, and Europe's in the same position. They're like, well, we may as well throw open the borders, and you know, we'll do what we can to limit things, and everyone who's on a plane has to have a test on both ends, and wait a day or two to make sure that. So it's not a 2 week quarantine anymore. It's a test as you get on the plane, and you know, a result as you're getting after a 1 day quarantine on the other end. Is that there's scenarios where the rest of the world could be opening up at that stage? Do you think Australia would say, okay, that's it? No, we're going to lock ourselves down and not interact with the rest of the world that has started interacting with each other? Or do you think Australia would say, well, we need to just move on to the acceptance stage along with everyone else?
Well, I would say, excuse me, that, you know, even overseas where it's not 6 months away, it's longer and more like 12 probably. Mm. But we're way behind that curve, if that is a curve, or a sort of psychological viral curve, if you like. You know, we have prided ourselves on getting rid of the thing. You know, can you really see either a premier or a prime minister saying, okay, well, I know we've only got 50 virus cases here, but we're throwing open the borders and everybody get a mask? Mm. I mean, I can't see it happening.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is that the more successful you are, the more resistance there is to do this. You know, places where it's already run rampant, it's like, well, we don't have much to lose. But Australia does have a lot to lose.
It is a bit paradoxical. Yeah, like the greater success you have. But I guess that's the key to this entire podcast is that, you know, Australia was always extremely well positioned to fight the virus, obviously with you know, being an island and it starting in the Northern Hemisphere, us being in summer. You know, we always had a really good shot at containing the virus.
And our big cities are a long way away from each other. They're not easily, you can't easily drive.
Yes, lots of advantages centers that have played out, you know, in a very successful antivirus campaign. But
relatively wealthy as well as another one.
But, and a good health system, all of those things. But at the same time, you know, the structure of the economy was always far more vulnerable to the virus, and that's what we're talking about here, is the virus success, you know, actually equals economic failure.
yes, absolutely. And I'm with you on that case. All I'm trying to do is I'm trying to tag up and say, I know, and just to make it clear to listeners, you know, I'm certainly in on the case that I do think there is going to be this dramatic fall in the number of people coming in and immigration and all that. I'm just trying to make sure that I'm just trying to explore those other sides of the argument to make sure that we've caught it. Not with a view that I think that's what's going to happen, but more just to try and explore as a devil's advocate view.
I think a more likely scenario is that they will try and build out some kind of quarantine capacity and get as many people in as they can, as safely as they can. But I guess we're making the point that, the history of this virus being so contagious, quarantine failures are just part and parcel with the thing. And so every time you try this, you're likely to end up with a quarantine failure and blowback.
Yep.
Yeah, and we've witnessed this in New Zealand as well, where they've had similar failures. And Jacinda Ardern, their prime minister, has said no international roles this year. Blanket said it, and everyone seems to be supporting it there. So, I guess the last point before we move on is also, obviously, Australia's biggest source of international students and almost our biggest source of migrants is from China, obviously, and Australia's in open diplomatic war with China. So that's obviously a stiff headwind. The Chinese authorities are dissuading Chinese students from coming to Australia and we expect that sort of moral suasion to only pick up from here.
I'll just add at that point, I mean, there is the offset potentially there with Hong Kong refugees. Obviously the UK overnight offered to take in 40% of Hong Kong. and the fresh news just coming into the podcast was that ScoMo was mulling, some kind of moratorium for honkies. That's likely, but the Chinese hostilities will intensify considerably if we do that. And so I would see Hong Kong only as a smaller offset than falling Chinese numbers.
A stopgap.
It'd be some offset, but I wouldn't think it'd be enough. I mean, there's 7.5 million or so in Hong Kong. The UK's offered to take 3 million. I don't know if we can take the other 4.5 million, but I don't think we'd be talking huge numbers.
All right, very good. We'll jump across to foreign buyers' role in property.
Those various segments that we've discussed have at times played very strong roles in Australian property price growth and as well, all of the spillovers into activity that we discussed earlier, particularly construction, apartments, etc. So much so, in fact, that, we basically had a foreign buyer-led property price boom in 2016-17. It was coupled with a big investor boom, wasn't all foreign buyer driven, but it was certainly foreign buyers started it around 2014-15. And there's some charts here on the history of demand.
Yeah, and I think that was also the point where Australia decided to look the other way on. I think just prior to that, I think hockey was sort of getting stuck into some forced sales of foreign bought property and things like that, and then. Started the task force, and then the Hockey and Abbott left, and they basically just defunded that whole task force, and
Turnbull,
looked the other way.
Turnbull welcomed the illegal buying. But anyway, I mean that boom was probably largely killed at the Chinese end when the yuan ran into all sorts of difficulties when it started to fall and. The China, for its own reasons, can't allow that to happen quickly or enduringly. So it's shut its capital account and, that really choked off the flow of funds into Australian property. And you can see that in the sort of boom and bust in our second chart there, which is the NAB survey of property professionals. It shows a big spike up into 2014-15 and then the falling away after the capital controls. And basically it's been falling ever since. Current indicators are that it's still falling, falling away quite sharply from, things like Jiuwei, Chinese buyer inquiries into Australia. So You know, I wouldn't necessarily see any kind of flight from Australian property from foreign buyers, although there are reports today of 1 in 10 previous, well, extant buyers of Australian apartments walking away. A lot of that has probably got a an international element, and so people actually dumping their deposits probably through lack of financing or simply seeing the market as turning to toast. So, you know, that may be playing a role, actually, capital flight, but I guess the main issue here is that that foreign buyers' role in property price appreciation is unlikely to return, very unlikely to return, and will probably actually weigh on prices at the margin. So that'll bring us through to rents and the rental crash. So I'll throw back to you, Leith.
Yeah, so obviously with the collapse in immigration and international students and the like, that's obviously led to a big increase in vacancies. But we've also had another impact as well, because the tourism sector is absolutely destroyed at the moment, and obviously borders are shut internationally, but also some domestically. We've seen this phenomenon where a whole bunch of short-term lettered properties like Airbnbs have been dumped onto the long-term property market. The long-term rental market. So what this has done is it's led to a huge increase in supply, in rental supply. And according to SQM Research, which does a monthly vacancy report, Sydney, for example, their vacancy rate's running at the highest level on record, over 4%, and Melbourne's is also rising. But the biggest story here is actually this in the capital city CBD areas, where, for example, Sydney's CBD vacancy rate was 8% in May, in May last year, and it's actually ballooned to about 16%. And Brisbane and Melbourne have also ballooned into double digits. So there's been this really sharp rise in rental vacancies. And the other issue there is that that despite the fact that dwelling approvals have collapsed, there's still a really large pipeline of new apartments that were approved several years ago that are only now being added to the market. So you've got this sort of triple whammy where you've got collapsing immigration, a big flood of supply from short-term rentals like Airbnbs, as well as new supply being added. And the result is that that rents are now falling. And rents were already incredibly weak. If you adjust for inflation, Australian rents have actually fallen for a decade. So the situation is getting even worse, especially if you're a negatively geared property investor where you're facing this big flood of supply. You're battling to get a tenant, and and obviously your rental income's falling, and now prices are obviously falling as well, according to CoreLogic. So you're sort of caught between this pincer. And I'll use that as a segue to get onto the Australia's long Achilles heel in this space, and that's the sheer number of loss-making property investors we've got in Australia.
I thought that was a feature, not a bug.
That's right. This has long been a risk for Australia, but it's never, hasn't come to fruition because we've had the collapsing mortgage rates for years, and we've always managed to, kick the can down the road. But according to the Australian Tax Office, about 1 in 10 taxpayers or 1.3 million landlords were negatively geared or loss-making in financial year 17. That's the most recent data they've got. And as I just mentioned, so these are effectively landlords that are paying their property negative carry. They're effectively, paying their property a yield in the hope that it repays them with capital growth. Well, both of those are now, both rents and property prices are falling. So the wedge between falling property prices, falling rents, of course, you've got rising unemployment, you've got falling household incomes, and they're also facing increased competition from new apartments that have been bought online, as well as obviously Airbnbs that are flooding onto the market. So the upshot of all this is that, that property investors are likely to, especially those who come under financial pressure, either because they've lost their job or because they were already, cutting it pretty fine, are likely to dump their properties or be forced to sell. And there's already been...
There may even be some who look at that that equation and think, I better get out.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, yeah, dumping properties have been forced to sell. And we're already seeing it. There's already been quite a few media reports from the past month or so of investors dumping their apartments, or as you mentioned, Dave, not settling on off the plan property purchases. So it's just another one of those risks that are built in for the property market.
But keep in mind as well, and for listeners, is that we're in this moratorium period now, where basically banks are letting people get away with not paying the mortgages and letting people get away with switching to just interest or whatever, because it was that whole view about, look, it's a 6-month hibernation or whatever. And so I think most of the non-bank guys sort of, I think maybe 3 or 4 months was what they were giving out. So that's coming up to a close now. And they've got to make another decision as to whether they're going to let people keep going. And whereas most of the banks had rolled people over till September. And it's a question about how much longer they're going to let that go on before they start. You'd have to think that they'd certainly be looking at some of the higher risk ones who've been out of work for 6 months. With a bunch of properties, and just start saying, well, no, you do have to start letting a few of these properties go, even though we might let you keep rolling over your interest on some of the other things.
And just put some hard numbers around that. According to the Australian Bankers Association, just under 500,000 mortgage holders have deferred their mortgage repayments for up to 6 months, and that sums up to about $175 billion worth of mortgages. So that's 1 in 14. Mortgage holders have deferred at $176 billion. So, it's not small change here. It's quite a lot of money.
No, and importantly, it's not. These aren't write-offs or write-downs or anything like that as well. It's basically saying, yes, you've managed to do that, but so, if you're looking at a best case scenario, if you thought, hey, the world will be back to where it was in 3 or 4 months' time, and so you go, yes, everyone's back to earning what they used to earn, but there's actually all this massive amount of debt that's sort of been piled in on all those people, so the amount of money they can actually go out and spend is therefore reduced as well, in terms of you've got this whole debt burden. Even if you miraculously made it back to the same economy we had 6 months ago, it's the same economy but with a whole bunch of extra debt added. So
and also obviously emergency income support also expiring at about the same time, or it'll probably get rolled over to some extent, but the civil forces, so you got both JobKeeper, JobSeeker, legislated to finish at the end of September alongside this, the ending of this 6-month mortgage repayment freeze. So this is what people keep saying.
There's also the eviction moratorium.
Of course,
It ends at the same time.
Well,
and
bankruptcy ones as well. So in terms of, there's a lot of companies that they're basically saying, they're not going to follow them down the bankruptcy path until for
the moratorium.
The thing is, a lot of these will be extended though.
Good stepping off point for policy and see how they'll respond, which is our next.
Actually, Dave, just before we do that, we've got just one question. I thought we might just drop into this one just in relation to the debt sort of theme. Is there a way for government to manipulate the housing market to undergo a beautiful deleveraging, to quote Ray Dalio, or are the only two options to kick the can down the road or have a property crash? Maybe as a segue into these policy exhaustion topic as well.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any doubt that they'll try, and that goes back to that range of extraordinary cliffs that we face in September. That's obviously not going to happen. They're going to be, some of those things will be pushed forward. It looks like they'll certainly be tightening JobKeeper and JobSeeker, which is the dole. We'll get a bit of a lift as the alternative, but it will be an income tightening. I'm not sure that they'll extend the eviction moratorium either, but some of those things are definitely going to have to get pushed forward. We just give a bit of structure to this this component of the conversation. Sorry, guys. Do you want to take this one over, Lisa?
Yeah, sure.
I'm not sure what's going on. Running through policy exhaustion and options. Looking at banks tightening lending standards and the RBA out of bullets.
Yeah, that's right. So look, what I'd like to see, if we're talking about kicking the can down the road, ideally, you know, I'd like to see the government just throw away the old fiscal straitjacket and worrying about all this, you know, debt and deficit stuff and whatever, and just look at the economy and say, look, we've got all this spare capacity, we've got all these people unemployed. Let's for starters, let's keep JobSeeker at its current level. It's currently expanded level of $1,100 a fortnight. So to give all Australians a safety net. And at the same time, let's start doing, you know, old school stimulus measures like building public housing, building infrastructure, all that stuff to get people employed and also build things that give Australia payoffs and improve living standards going forward. And also, you know, solve the homeless crisis, things that'll boost productivity in the long term. That's what I like to see. Will they do it? Probably to a certain degree. I think, as Dave mentioned, I think they'll probably taper down JobKeeper quite a lot. The banks will kick the can a little bit on some of these mortgages, and they'll probably take more of a fine tooth comb rather than saying everyone can just do a 6-month freeze. They'll probably start going through the individual borrower circumstances and kicking the can on those that they think are a good, you know, have good longer-term prospects, and pulling the trigger on those that are obviously facing a, you know, more dire circumstances. And I'm sure they'll do some sort of stimulus, but at the moment it looks more like they're going to target tax cuts and all these other things that don't really give you a very good bang for your buck, and tends to give money to people who aren't going to spend it.
Just worth putting that into perspective, just to our listeners, Leith, is that, you know, we bang on about a fair bit is some of these inequality issues, but the issue more is that you give $1,000 to Australia's poorest person and they're out paying off their credit card, spending that money, or re-bringing up, I suppose, paying off the credit card, then putting it back on again, spending on whatever they can. Whereas you give another $1,000 to, say, Gina Rinehart, and she's just going to throw it on the pile and not spend it. So in terms of actually getting more people, getting more demand so that other people can be employed, you're far better off giving more money away to poorer people because they'll actually go out and spend it quickly. And so you're bringing forward the tax cuts for rich people that were sort of mooted last time isn't going to do a lot for demand, because it's going to go to people who are already quite wealthy, and they're just going to throw it on the pile or stick it back in the stock market or in the housing market as an investment, rather than actually get out and spend it on and therefore create jobs with the extra demand.
I had to tune out for a second there. Did you guys cover monetary policy?
No.
Not yet. No.
All right. All right. Well, I mean, that's the key for a beautiful deleveraging. But, you know, sadly for Australia, the RBA is out of bullets, and mortgage rates, if they can get them down at all, it'll be very, very small reductions. Now, having said that, the recent cuts, you know, are some support for the housing market as it is. And we're seeing, you know, some pretty juicy deals, especially on fixed-term mortgages at the moment, down around, you know, 2.2%, even 2%. And so that is some shorter-term support. And we have, you know, analysts like Chris Joy basically hanging their hat on that as, you know, likely to drive a new boom. But I think, you know, a key part of that is that households basically realise that they're, you know, at the end of their rope here. And the RBA put, as it were, the RBA insurance policy that they've always relied on to come in and make their mortgages much cheaper whenever the rubber hits the road, is now bankrupt. You know, although that will provide some support and may help diminish the downside, I can't see it generating any kind of new boom. It's difficult to see mortgages getting any cheaper. I mean, on the other side of the coin, we've got lending standards where banks are tightening, obviously, you know, because they're seeing this stress in the market, and that's how they respond to these things. I think you can expect to see APRA campaign to keep lending standards really, really loose, which is the opposite of their job, of course, but that's what they do. And you'll certainly see more of that, which will again aid, you know, the possibility of a beautiful deleveraging. But I guess the risk is, even if you see, you know, a sort of slow fall in property prices, in some in nominal and some in real terms, when you have this huge group of investors that are, you know, doing this negative carry into capital growth, they're going to be a constant sore in the market. And we're already seeing this in the data, or the credit data. Like, we've got first home buyers who are being incentivized all over the place to buy property, still going quite strongly. But investors are absolutely plummeting in terms of their borrowing. So this is already a reality to some extent. And if you are faced with a beautiful deleveraging, the question is, would those investors, you know, start to bolt for the exit? You know, a beautiful deleveraging when you're running a negative carry is a disaster. So, you know, can you do a beautiful deleveraging when you have such a large segment reliant on continual capital growth?
And our is other my point, question. Yeah, and the other point we've made a few times on these various podcasts is that we've basically, as you said, we've shot all our bullets before we even got to the battle. Like, we sort of sat there trying to prop this housing market up for the last 3 or 4 years, and APRA's already been loosening everything they possibly can just to try and hold house prices where they were. And now we've actually got a financial shock. They've already used most of the loosened as much of the sensible stuff, and so anything else they've got to do now starts to get the this is not sensible, and the banks, quite frankly, probably aren't going to want to do a lot of it unless they're sort of, you know, they'll need to be extremely incentivized to get out there. I mean, I keep using this small business one as a great example, where where this $40 billion was meant to go out to small businesses, and the government was taking half the risk on it. And trying to push, you know, as much of this lending out as they could at cheap rates to all the small businesses. And it looks like banks are probably going to lend out 4 of it. So, you know, you basically got a 90% lower than what their target is. And, yeah. And it's that same issue that you get in the housing market, in that APRA might be really keen for it, and Morrison and Co. might be really keen to try and get everyone to take out 95% mortgages. But if banks are sitting there going, you know what, I'd prefer not to lend 95% to somebody who's at a high likelihood of losing their job, then the money just won't get out there.
Yep.
There's also the demand question. In the recent consumer sentiment rebound, which has been pretty good, house price expectations have barely risen at all. I think that's largely because everybody instinctively understands that without immigration, you know, the demand side of things just isn't there. And so, you know, people who might want to buy property for an investment or indeed to live in, you know, they're simply going to start to pause and think, is this really, you know, the time to do it? And so there's nothing that monetary policy can really do about that. That's your classic pushing on a string, as people want to deleverage or just wait for cheaper prices. But it throws you over to fiscal, and we already have, you know, kind of huge fiscal incentives for first home buyers. I think in WA or Tasmania, or maybe both, you can get as much as 70K
for newly constructed property.
For a newly constructed property, they're not as generous for existing, but you know, they were working to some extent before the crisis, but now, you know, the only thing I could see them doing is to throw back to another first home buyer's grant on existing property, which would probably be short term, and those have been having diminishing impact at the margin every time they've used them. So they really are kind of fiscal as well as looking. You know, the cupboard's looking a little bit bare.
Now, the one thing you haven't thrown up on this list, David, is the superannuation stuff, because it seems that on the superannuation side, people could draw down $10,000 last financial year, and as of yesterday or whatever, they can now apply for another $10,000
if they meet the conditions. If they, you got to make
the conditions, yeah. but they weren't checking the conditions. So the issue is
they may later though. So
they might later, and there's been a few warnings and all that type of stuff. But the reality is they haven't been checking, and that's been the number of people who've drawn down on that. And to me, that's actually one of the, I think it gets underplayed as to how big of a support that is for the Australian economy.
Huge.
Because it was quick. As well, like it wasn't like a lot of the some of the JobKeeper and JobSeeker stuff was sort of along the lines of the employer can pay it first if they've still got the money, and then we'll give the employer some money back later and all these other things, whereas that was like no you make an application and within 5 days here's your money,
check.
And so there's no extra debt as well, like, and for a lot of people this was money that they weren't expecting to see for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, if ever. And so it was just here's a bit of free money so you weren't putting the Australian economy, well, you're putting your retirement of these people in a worse position, but from a debt perspective, you're not making a difference to it. So it is actually a great source for trying to bail economies out of these issues, whether or not it was, the targeting and all that type of stuff was right. So I guess, what are we hearing on that front?
It all goes down to yes, it adds to the fiscal support. We've also had the buyer's guarantee business, which allows you to reduce your deposit size, and then you add some of that super. Then
also supplement payments as well, like $1,500 twice for anyone who's on the welfare.
So first-time buyers are getting a leg up. Definitely into this market, and so that is some support. But I mean, typically, traditionally.
I was asking more about: are we hearing, or are you expecting sort of further stuff to come on that front? Because to me, that's a relatively rich source,
there are coalition elements that are always banging on about, for instance, allowing younger people to access that super pool for deposits.
Yes.
So that's certainly possible. But as you say, I mean, they're more or less getting access to that now.
I think it's a little bit overplayed as well. I mean, just because we're only talking about $17 billion that's been withdrawn so far, averaging 7,500 each. So
only 17 billion.
No, $17 billion across an economy is not massive. But. And the thing about it is $7,500 each, and as Dave rightfully just said, even if the government does bring that policy in, well, we know that the people that have been doing this early super are basically young people, and they're probably exhausted their superannuation savings anyway. So I don't know how much more they can pull out of it, presuming they do.
Look, I think it will be a support, I think you can expect more fiscal support for first home buyers, definitely.
Yeah, right. Sure.
The question is that enough to outweigh exiting investors? And if you like, cautious first home buyers, who see the market coming back further, I don't think it will be either. I mean, it's very traditionally been the case that investors have driven property price appreciation in Australia. They've always had access to more capital than first home buyers. So, I think their exiting would be the marginal price setter to the downside.
Yeah. Especially in Sydney and Melbourne is where the investors are most active, or have been traditionally most active. Those happen to be the two cities which are going to be most impacted by this immigration collapse. So
does anyone else have any crazy Hail Mary options that we think
Yeah, David, you and I have discussed one that I sort of don't want to. I sort of don't want to publicly say, just in case I
give them the idea.
Give them the ideas, because there's a couple. I mean, I think there are some policy options that you do see in other countries generally well past where you've actually hit the crisis. Like after the crisis is finished, there's sort of cleanup operations which you could in theory start now, which would actually effectively. It's effectively bailing out the banks and giving them a chance to. I think there's a number of those ones which are possible. I don't think they're likely, and I think the moral hazard issues and there's all these other issues.
So sorry, the actual example though, like a debt jubilee, is that what you're saying?
More sort of. As I said, I sort of don't want to give. I don't want to give any politicians any ideas because. But there are things they can. Let's just say that there's things that they can do out there which are sort of don't go along with normal capitalism.
Yep.
Which could easily unleash another wave of in my view, could easily unleash another wave of borrowing. But. With immense moral hazard and immense other issues, and it probably just means you're just going to build yourself up to another
tech. Just expect you to do it again in a couple of years' time, sort of thing.
But I think they're possible. I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think they're likely. Mm-hmm. But I think if you invest, anyone investing at the moment needs to keep into account that Morrison did come out and say higher house prices under a Liberal government, and maybe he means even if that means the the death of capitalism and. Where the central bank will have the RBA effectively backstopping all these banks to force them to get out and lend so that more people can buy houses. As I said, I don't think it's likely, but I do think there's some extreme things you could do, especially when you own your own printing press that could prop housing prices up.
Just make the point that yes, those things are risk case, but even those are going to take. Pretty serious accident first.
Yeah, we hope so.
I think so. You'd need a crisis to trigger those kind of interventions.
Yes, we have a crisis.
I guess
what I'm saying is we need a house price crisis.
That's right. You'd like to think so.
Although the virus obviously is the great fig leaf for any kind of giveaway you like. I still think you would need a pretty decent house price crisis to get them thinking too crazily.
Yeah, that's right. But I do think, let me make clear though, I don't think they're the likely. I think the most likely scenario is what we've pointed out here, which is all these things fall over we're certainly out of any good policy options. Let's put it that way. There's no good policy options left.
Yeah. Okay, so... Well,
very good.
That throws us over to investment implications, at least from a macro point of view. I wrote a piece this today saying markets are wrong, that Australia is well positioned in the rebound. They're mistaking what was, exceptional positioning on the virus for exceptional positioning for the economy on the virus.
So, David, when you say markets, we're talking stock market?
I think the stock market's just... basically following whatever happens in the US. Probably the stock market a little bit. I think the currency to some extent as well. But
even bonds are higher in Australia than what you're seeing in a lot of other countries as well.
Yeah, definitely bonds, yep. So,
and I guess where David's pushing on that one is this point about the Australian market is very different to a lot of other markets in that we ran through all these things. We're very exposed to banks and we're very exposed to resources. Resources rely on world growth. Banks are relying on the property market. So we're just compared to say the US where both those are just a pimple on the butt of the stock market.
Yep.
So the bottom line is domestic demand is going to be severely challenged while we struggle with these people flows. Or lack of them, and this sort of nice little Ponzi scheme that we run with population growth and house price growth. As those two come off together, then domestic demand, as we saw in the bust of 2018-19 with the Royal Commission, consumption will follow house prices, and it is already going to be challenged by God knows what on the income side, but we're going to see balance sheet problems for households as well. And so seeing Australia as a domestic fortress because we've contained the virus is the opposite conclusion to what you should draw.
Can I jump in for one sec?
Yeah.
So I just want to point out that, contrary to popular belief, before the COVID-19 even hit, the Australian economy was incredibly fragile place. I mean, once you strip out population growth, we effectively had close to zero domestic demand growth over the last decade. So we were already going into this virus with basically no domestic demand growth, excluding immigration. So obviously stripping immigration out now. Yes, that's right. So you know, without immigration and the economy that existed before COVID-19, we basically had no real domestic demand growth. And then now you had the COVID-19 downturn. Well, you know, you can work that out yourself.
Yeah. Mm.
We move on to the next point, I'll just let everyone that's listening in live know to head over to nucleuswealth.com/webinar if you've got any final questions, just as we're wrapping up soon. So head in there and we can answer those. But, yeah, take it away, Dave. Thanks, mate.
Yeah. And so there's right now, you know, this equation gives you an unusually high risk of an investor run on property. And there's actually one underway of sorts with investor credit, you know, plunging at the moment, and, you know, the likelihood is that that's going to continue. Whether it intensifies, you know, will depend on the various things we've discussed today, but it's the highest risk of that I've ever seen, I think, in my couple of decades of observing this. So, you know, implications for certain sectors, I mean, anything domestic demand exposed is facing, you know, quite a lot of risk. Banks, even though they've been discounted during the bust, have rebounded to a point of almost historical overvaluation despite this outlook. So wouldn't be going there. And then even if you start to get the bailouts and the crazy policy and can kicking and what have you, you know, so long as we cannot return to the immigration Ponzi, you know, we're looking at severe secular stagnation. And, you know, the only way out of that is going to be a weak Australian dollar, and we'll have sort of grind through trying to rebuild our non-mining tradable sectors. And, you know, so you can expect over time, you know, for currency, monetary policy and fiscal supports to also start to focus on those areas.
Okay, very good. Anything else, Damien? It's a note, ASX above 6,000 today. I think it probably covers off on the top point there.
Well, maybe we'll hit a few questions.
Well, it's coming through, yep. We've got the one there on that note. The market test 6,000 points built on a ridiculous optimism against every indicator. Probably not so much a question as a note there, but I think we'll...
question about the property, about job seeker.
Yeah, well, to the panel, will the government chicken out and continue with, they've called it property keeper, but I think it's job keeper, almost certainly, do you think?
I think they'll try and target it a little bit better and they'll wind it back. So there's a few thoughts about what they do. They might continue it at a lower rate and treat part-time workers differently to full-time workers, because at the moment, being a $1,500 flat payment per fortnight, we've got this perverse situation where some areas of the economy actually experience a pay rise. So if you're a younger person doing, you know, a couple hours a week at Target or Kmart or whatever, you actually got a massive pay rise. Whereas it's, you know, obviously different if you're a full-time worker who's earning more money. So there's thinking they might try and tailor it better, so treat part-time workers differently to full-time or casuals, who long-term casuals. And also, or alternatively, the government might pull it back completely and just try and focus assistance on areas that are hardest hit, like aviation or travel.
Throw everybody else onto the boosted job seeker.
Yeah, job seeker, that's right. So yeah. Personally, I think, you know, Dave and I agree on this point. I think is what we'd rather see is, you know, perhaps some targeted assistance at like the aviation industry or an industry that's been directly impacted because of government decree, but get rid of JobKeeper and just keep JobSeeker at the higher rate and basically let the chips fall where they may. Because while you have this JobKeeper system let's face it, it's been gamed by certain parties. There's others who miss out, who shouldn't. You're always going to have distortions where businesses that really should be open and should close, because, you know, for example, we've got way too many cafes. They should be allowed to be a little bit of creative destruction Those who are the most inefficient shut down, but there also needs to be a safety net to catch those who are affected. And that's what JobSeeker really is.
Yeah.
So I mean, rather than keeping zombie businesses going.
Yeah. Even the government is saying that tourism is unlikely to return before 2024. So, I mean, you can't sustain a policy based on keeping employees in touch with employers for 4 years. I mean, those businesses simply don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
So I think you could expect JobKeeper to just steadily be wound back, and everybody over time will end up on the dole where need be.
Okay, yeah, thanks for that. Got another one that just came in. Given welfare is the biggest line item in the budget and the age pension the biggest welfare spend, is there any chance the sacred cow of the pension not being means tested against the family home being addressed? Will there be a greater debate about intergenerational fairness?
Not in the near term. To be honest with you, all these issues are longer term issues. At the moment, we're dealing with a crisis, and I think the government just needs to focus on ensuring there's an adequate safety net for everyone, and worry about all these longer term issues in a couple of years' time down the track when the time's right. That's my personal view.
Yeah,
I mean, I agree. There's a major issue in intergenerational fairness here, given young people have worn the brunt of this virus adjustment.
And rated their super.
Yeah, in terms of their wealth and income. But it hasn't been mentioned. I mean, if anyone out there is listening, I've been trying to get somebody to start the Australian Youth Political Party for 10 years because there needs to be some advocacy with some heavy-hitting support that can take votes away, or this rotting will continue forever.
Mm. And I guess the issue with the family home, being pension tested, that's negative for house prices, and so therefore
that won't happen.
Yeah, that's right. Good point.
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I was making the point. I've made it a couple of times, and it's about, and I just need to be careful about how I'm phrasing it. But I think it's important. It's important to note that there's this big push in terms of Black Lives Matters and a lot of the Me Too movement and stuff like that that's really taken off in recent years. And those movements absolutely have cause for concern, and you need to address. They have issues that need to be addressed, but I think they're probably sucking a lot of the oxygen out of the air for the intergenerational fairness issues, which means that and maybe it's right that those are the two issues that should be addressed first, but it does mean that I think there's the population only has a certain number of things they can keep in front of their mind. They've got short attention spans, and there's only so many things you can be protesting about at once, and it does appear to me that those are the things that will be protested about at the moment. And so that sort of doesn't leave a lot of room for David's new youth political party, which is David gets further and further away from as time goes on. Well, we all get further and further away from, I guess.
Well, I mean, it is that sort of sad irony that it's, and more power to them for protesting, but that it's youth out there protesting over various forms of abuse or unfairness, and that's fair enough, but I really do wish that they'd take a moment to consider themselves as a class, if you like, because they're being seriously abused.
Couple of last ones here. So after the Eden Monaro by-election, will raising the GST be back on the agenda, making input costs to housing higher?
Nope. I mean, Josh Frydenberg said pretty clearly today that that they're not looking at it, and that they're looking at tax cuts. So, I mean, I've got no issues with addressing the GST as long as it's part of a broad-based Ken Henry style tax review where you do a whole lot of stuff. But again, this gets back to the point that I made earlier with the pension. I just don't think this is the right time, to be honest with you. Like, worry about these issues in 18 months, 2 years, whatever. But right now, I think all the focus should be on making sure that there's an adequate safety net that catches everyone who falls in the next 6 months or so, and then making sure that this September fiscal cliff that we're approaching isn't too steep. I think that's where the focus should be on, and worry about all this other stuff later. I just think the second order thing right now.
Well, I guess I'll push back a little bit on that, Leith. I would have actually preferred to see, you know, a party with a longer term view about these things, and might use this example, for example, to say, right, we're going to move to land taxes, but we're actually going to ditch stamp duties right now, and we'll gradually build up land taxes over the next 20 years or something like that. And in the meantime, we'll debt fund it to help, you know, we'll get the RBA to print money and give it to us. Or, you know, there's a bunch of different things you could do if you had a far-sighted government party with an agenda and a strategy and a plan. But I think both our parties are there basically saying, what's the latest issue? What's a good media release first? And then maybe if there's some policy that comes out the back of that, then, you know, that might be nice.
What can I execute in 3 years?
Probably the next guy's problem anyway, so I shouldn't worry too much about it. So I guess I'm sort of coming from the point of view is I don't think this, I think this environment would be good for changes, but I just don't think we have the political will at the moment to actually or attention span to actually make long dated changes to these things.
Yeah, well, I guess where I'm coming from is I see these flashing red signals in September when all this stuff unwinds, and I want that addressed first, I guess, and I want to address properly before we worry about all this other stuff, because, you know, all this talk about the GST, et cetera, is, you know, shifted focus away from this fiscal cliff, mortgage cliff, everything that's coming late September. So I sort of want policymakers to look at that first and foremost.
One last one, actually, we'll just finish on a bit of a high note here, but or positive note perhaps, but what do you think the government could do to create jobs? So example, starting new industries or encouraging manufacturing, gents, what are your thoughts?
Oh, good Lord. Change the entire economic model.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, lower property prices would be a great start. You know, if you didn't have to spend all this money on rent, that'd be a very good.
Well, there's energy, which is another big input.
Yeah,
a lot of people.
Those prices wild as well.
Yeah, my other big one would be, I'd love to see a lot of the money spent on R&D. And look, my take is I just want to say I'm intimately involved on a day-to-day basis with the world's biggest companies, looking at what they're doing in terms of new projects and all that type of stuff. And there are very, very, very few multinational companies that take long-term views and actually say, yes, we'll go and explore some potential backwater that might actually be fantastic, but the odds are really, really low. And that's sort of the job. I think that is the job of governments, and we're pulling. I think a lot of governments globally have been pulling back on R&D spend and expecting companies to do it. And companies will do the last stages of R&D spend, or they'll do the iterations of R&D spend, and they're very good at doing
where the patents are.
Yeah, and they're very good at saying somebody's developed something. Now let's commercialize it, and let's then and let's make all these tweaks to make it more efficient. But those big scientific breakthroughs that actually require heaps and heaps and heaps of failures, scientific failures, are not good from a government. And so, you know, if there was a new industries and places to be spending money, that's where I'd love to see that governments are actually saying, let's drag the economy up by the middle class rather than sprinkling some money, some tax cuts at the top and hoping it would, they'll trickle down.
Yep.
Yeah. Man, I wouldn't object to some MMT chiming in there.
Mm. Yeah, right. Okay, very good. All right, lovely. So on that note, we'll jump across to our question of the week. And so for those that are listening in live or also listening post the live show today, do you agree that Australian property is set for massive falls? Let us know in the YouTube comments of this video. I won't ask the panel for their thoughts because I think we've just spent an hour plus on exactly that. But let us know your answers to the question in the comments of the video, and we can take it from there. So thanks, gents, for a cracking chat today, and we'll look forward to next week.
So just finishing up, we hope you enjoyed today's show. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nicholaswealth.com/content. To stay up to date on news from us, follow us on social media. We always appreciate guest or topic suggestions, so if you've got one, please drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video. And finally, if you know someone who gets something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share it with your friends, and help our podcast grow. So on that note, thanks for tuning in, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.